attention to the fact that we think there's actually a wider diversity or variety of stratospheric anomalies or changes in conditions in the stratosphere that can influence extreme weather lower down in the atmosphere compared with what conventionally has been really looked at with most of previous research. So I think that's it's really drawing attention to the fact that we need a more complete understanding of some of these anomalies and extremes with stratospheric conditions, how they're connected with lower down in the atmosphere and in terms of extreme weather events.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Dr. Edward Hanna is on the line. We are talking severe winter weather and the stratosphere.
In the Severe Weather Europe blog, André Fleece finds three key factors are lined up to predict a serious cold air outbreak next winter. And everybody from city managers to social agencies would like a prediction. Is it too soon? And if so, how far in advance can we know severe cold is on the way?
So that's a really interesting point, and they're really looking at several key factors, including the QBO that we've already discussed, but also conditions, sea ice conditions in the Arctic and how that might be influenced with changes high up in the atmosphere above the Arctic. And then they're also looking at, ENSO, I think, in the Pacific, so El Nino, Southern Oscillation. So what they're trying to do is to predict changes in these three conditions or looking at recent changes in these conditions and see if that can give some clues or insights into the next few months' conditions in the stratosphere with the polar vortex activity. And I think there is something in this kind of approach. You can't get a perfect prediction, of course, from just three factors, but it's certainly part of the physical connectivity or potential connectivity of what's happening and trying to... There are some time lags with some of these what we call teleconnections or remote links between different parts of the atmosphere or different parts of the Earth system. And so that's the basis also of some of the, for example, machine learning prediction models that try to do seasonal weather forecasting that have recently been developed.
Well, we're running out of time, but can you briefly tell us what are you working on next?
So we're basically trying to follow up on some of the some of the ideas from the big review synthesis paper that motivated this interview. So I think a number of us are working on different parts of what's a very big research area. So some of us looking at changes in high latitude, blocking the causes and impacts of that. Others are looking at new ways of defining variations and extreme events in the stratosphere and trying to understand how this might be linked with conditions further down with some of the extreme cold air outbreaks. But also we're trying to motivate the research from an end user or stakeholder perspective. So for example, with energy users, which is a big topic in the winter with the price of energy now in many parts of the world. For example, I've got a proposal to work with a national energy system operator here, for example, to try to better understand the societal and economic impacts of cold air outbreaks. And I guess if we could improve the weather forecast models and the global climate models to be able to predict these events and understand them, then the energy companies and other interested parties have longer lead-in time and can make better preparations. So that's one of the ideas. But I think there is a lot more work still to do to improve the climate models. So better predictability is the key, I think, of so that we can better prepare for these events, as well as just understanding them from a scientific perspective.
From University of Lincoln, we've been speaking with Edward Hanna. He is Professor of Climate Science and Meteorology and lead author in a new study about cold air outbreaks. You can find links to all the science we talked about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Edward, thank you for coming back and sharing your valuable time with us.
Thank you very much, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Climate models warn a much hotter world is coming within a single lifetime. This calls for drastic changes to our fossil-fueled civilization. But are those predictions solid? How does a global mean average actually show up in your country? International scientists have been working to cross-check the future against times of past warming. Our guest, Dr. Georgia Grant, helped develop a new tool using carefully analyzed sediments. She is a senior sedimentologist for GNS Science, which is now the new public research organization, Earth Sciences New Zealand. Georgia is a deep past explorer looking for echoes of the future. From Lower Hutt, New Zealand, Georgia Grant, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex.
In 2019, you investigated sea level rise during the Pliocene epoch with a focus on a short period of about 300,000 years, but it was about 3 million years ago. Why are scientists so interested in that mid-Pliocene warm period?
So this is the kind of touted as the last time Earth had carbon dioxide levels at 400 parts per million, like today. And at that time, the world was about 2 to 3 degrees warmer than present. And I might refer to the term an equilibrium, and so that's what we call when you look at the climate system over a long period, we can see that the temperature warmed to increase CO2.
Well, how could we possibly know the composition of the atmosphere millions of years ago?
Well, there's a couple of ways that we measure that by. The way that we directly measure carbon dioxide is in ice cores, where air bubbles have been trapped within the ice. But prior to ice cores, and in the time that we don't have ice to measure from, we use proxies, what we call proxy records. So it's there can be different elements that respond in a certain way, the ratio of those elements, and we can measure that today. And so we know that when we see those elements rise and fall, it's due to changing carbon dioxide levels.
This ancient warming period with CO2 levels that might have been similar to today, how long did it last and what preceded and followed that warming?
So for the last 50 million years or so, carbon dioxide levels have been dropping. Within that time period, there has been periods of it being slightly warmer and slightly cooler, but that long-term trend has been a response of the ocean predominantly taking up a lot of that carbon dioxide and storing it in sediments and taking it out of the system. That is the cycle that we have perturbed with the burning of fossil fuels and putting back in that carbon dioxide. But for this time period, it is very much within line of as that decrease happened. So it's just the last time that we had 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere.
And after years of collecting clues, how do you picture this previous warm period? I read that Florida was underwater, but did all the ice at the poles melt away?
So the sea level record that we built from sediments in New Zealand show on average that sea level was changing by about 20 metres over a glacial cycle. So it's quite a long time. It occurred over about 20,000 years. For reference, the last glacial maximum, the Ice Age, 20,000 years ago, sea level was 120 metres lower than today. But this was a warmer time period, so it was sea level that had risen above present. So the ice sheets at the moment can contribute 65 metres of sea level if they completely melted. What we saw were changes of about 20 metres, and so that meant a significant loss of the Greenland ice sheet, which holds currently about 7 metres of sea level, and an additional kind of 15 metres from Antarctica, which suggested that we lost a lot of the West Antarctic ice sheet, which is mostly a marine-based ice sheet sitting amongst an archipelago, as well as some of the terrestrial ice sheet from East Antarctica.
And at this time, the continents were in about the same position as they are now. And in that previous warming period, around 3 million years ago, what did sea level change mean for New Zealand?
In the scheme of things, well, in my geological brain, 20 metres doesn't change a lot for New Zealand in those past conditions. Today, 20 metres would mean a huge difference for a lot of our ports, and that's, you know, equally across the world. Certainly around the equator and the Pacific Islands and low-lying areas, as you say, like Florida, Bangladesh, those are the locations where just a little bit of sea level change means a huge amount. So I think in the context of today, it has a significant impact.
Yes, just for our American listeners, we're talking about over 75 feet of sea level change. You can imagine what that would mean. Now, Georgia Grant, you found the big climate models could not accurately recreate this ancient warm period. Is that right?
So climate models, the climate system is incredibly complex. And the computer models that various people across the globe have come together to create tend to do one or two parts of those system really well. So they might do the ocean and atmosphere interactions really well, or the ice sheet and ocean interaction really well. To do the whole global system is currently beyond our computer capacity. And so what we tend to do is look at the results of the different climate models and piece them together to understand what that whole system kind of might look like. But as I say, at the moment, we don't have a global climate model that can do every single region at a resolution that demonstrates the expression of change that's important for people in those different places.
Well, right. That is another focus in your 2023 paper published by the EGU. Global warming is not going to affect the whole planet equally. It does vary a lot between regions. I've seen a map of heat distribution during the mid-Pliocene, and the biggest heat changes circle and move towards the poles, while the tropics didn't change a lot. Now, that's bad news for my country of Canada, and I guess for New Zealand, too.
Yeah, that's a feature we call polar amplification, and it's the fact that any change in kind of temperature is really felt at the poles, and that's because they have so many aspects that are sensitive to the climate system, and when they change, they act as feedbacks. So they start to play into exacerbating that change. One of the key kind of expressions of that is the ice albedo effect. So white ice, that huge expanse of it, including sea ice seasonally, reflects a lot of heat back into the atmosphere. And when you start to warm the oceans and get rid of the sea ice, and like we've seen recently that the Arctic sea ice field is getting smaller and smaller, that means that more heat is entering the ocean, and that feeds back into the system and makes it harder for the sea ice to grow the next season. But I guess the simple way that I think about that regional expression of warming is that our global average temperature is currently 15 degrees. That's 1.1 degrees above the average of the last 2,000 years. So we've already warmed the globe by 1.1 degrees. But that global average temperature of 15 degrees includes a plus 57 degrees Celsius, you know, recorded in the US, and a minus 90 degrees Celsius recorded in Antarctica. There's a huge difference seasonally and across the globe in how that average temperature expresses itself. So I think it's important when we think about plus 2 degrees, which is the Paris target, that we reduce warming to 2 degrees, that 2 degrees might mean 6 degrees in one place and 1 degree in another place. And those differences have huge impacts on different countries, particularly like New Zealand with the maritime weather, and places like Florida, as you say, because of increasing extreme weather events that we see.
In a 2008 synthesis of science about this previous warming, the authors concluded the cause of the mid-Pliocene warmth remains unclear. Georgia, do we have a better idea now about what caused that previous warming?
I think the carbon dioxide levels, as I said, during the mid-Pliocene were on a long-term trend of decreasing carbon dioxide. At that time, it might have been slightly elevated from previous periods due to volcanic activity or dissolved carbon in warmer oceans, but it's certainly not considered a spike in CO2. It's just the last time that we had kind of regular interglacial periods where carbon dioxide was above 400 parts per million. So I think my key takeaway is always that it took 3 million years for the Earth to decrease CO2 from that 400 parts per million mark down to our pre-industrial 280 parts per million, and we've undone that in about 200 years.
Wow. I mean, that carbon cycle is slow if left to itself, but we've sped it right up. So your specialty is sediments, including their transport by waves and how that influences data drawn from those sediments, if I understood this correctly. How were the samples collected? How were they protected? And, for example, in your site in New Zealand?
We have a particular sequence of sediments that have been, and by sediments I mean mud and sand, that are deposited kind of near to the coastline and just in that out to 100 metres water depth. So, you know, as you go from the coast, from the beach, you have sandier sediments, and as you walk out, even within that short kind of period, you can feel that sediment getting finer underneath your feet, and eventually it kind of gets just to mud. That sequence was deposited over about 5 million years and then subsequently uplifted, and we now have that record on land. And the way that we access it best is by coring those sediments. And we do that so that we can get a continuous record. It's really important that we know the relative position of those sediments through time. Similar records that are drilled overseas would be kept refrigerated and are kept refrigerated, but we don't really have that infrastructure in New Zealand for this amount of sediment core. And indeed, the resources to keep cores like these, records of Earth's history, are under increasing pressure, and we've just seen the disestablishment of the International Ocean Drilling Program from the US that has supported vast amounts of knowledge through ocean drilling. And we have thousands of kilometres of sediment cores that are kept over the world. And it's a huge cost to keep that refrigerated.
Are you basing estimates of climate and ocean conditions a few million years ago directly on microfossils or on chemicals that living things leave behind?
We do both. So some of the temperature, again, proxy records, so it's a proxy of temperature. We're not directly measuring temperature. We can see what kind of species lived and the ratio of those species tell us what their preferred environment is. We can also measure the chemical traces that they leave behind, like the carbon chain lengths of the carbon molecule from specific marine algae can tell us how much kind of energy was in the system, how hot the temperature was.
Well, this gets a bit technical, but it is another amazing fact of nature. About a million years ago, the timing of glaciers expanding and contracting, so the ice ages, was coincident with 41,000 year cycles of the tilt of the Earth. Then for the last million years, the classic ice ages that we know, the time shifted to a 100,000 year pattern of the Earth's orbit. Do we know, or do we have informed guesses why this great ice clock and climate clock changed?
Yeah, so if you'll let me, I can go into a bit more detail on those cycles, because that was one of the main reasons I got into geology. These are termed Milankovitch cycles. They're the path that Earth's orbit takes about the sun, and that changes how much incoming solar radiation, how much radiation and heat is coming into Earth's system. And there are three main cycles. The 100,000-year cycle is how spherical Earth's orbit is. And that 41,000-year cycle you mentioned is the tilt of Earth's axes. And so that changes how much the poles receive, of how much temperature the poles receive. And then there's a third cycle, the 20,000-year cycle, which changes how our seasons are expressed. And there's a lot of interplay between these cycles. They certainly don't act in isolation. And I think that's the big thing that we're starting to see now, as we are able to recover new sediment records from across the globe, from Antarctica, from Greenland, from the equator. We can see that those cycles are dominant in different places. And that's because there's different parts of the climate system that respond to them. So one of the key things we've seen, learnt recently, is that the different parts of the Antarctic ice sheet, one of them responds better to kind of what we call top-down melting. So that's, you know, how warm it gets in summer determines how much melt there is. Whereas other parts of the Antarctic ice sheet, the marine-based, responds more to the 40,000-year or the bottom-up warming, and that's through the ocean system. So that shift from the 41,000-year world to the 100,000-year world has happened because the ice sheets have changed, and as they change in their size and in their location, as we had ice sheets that started to come down from the Arctic across the Northern Hemisphere continents, they started to respond to different thresholds in the system.
In your 2025 paper, you find sea level rise may have been somewhat overestimated, while still shockingly different from today, as much as 45 meters or 150 feet from the lows to the highs. Sea level rise might have been less extreme than some science suggested. You say this means lower ice sheet sensitivity. Now, if this is true, what does that mean for the future, for both sea level rise and how much polar glaciers will retreat?
Well, I think one of the important things to note is, and something that I should have mentioned more frequently in my answers, is that the time frames that I've been talking about are thousands of years. You know, these changes and these responses that I have generally looked at are quite hard to compare to modern change. Part of that is because, you know, as we discussed, the current change is happening a lot faster than the natural system. So there's a huge element to our current global warming that is completely incomparable to any other time in the past, because it's happening so quickly. But as well, these changes are that overall system that's happening, you know, as I said, in equilibrium. So we're not seeing how quickly that change is happening, just what the overall response would be if you change temperature by 2 to 3 degrees. It is also hinting at the fact that background climate states have a huge impact on the ability of the climate system as a whole to respond. So as we start to cross certain thresholds, like the 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide, and head towards 2 degrees warming, we can see features in the climate system, like marine-based ice sheets in West Antarctica, that can experience runaway melt. So that could happen. That's something that could happen very quickly.
When the funding for the Deep South Challenge was cut by the government in 2024, where does that leave the New Zealand Earth System model?
Yeah, look, that's a really important question, and thank you for asking that. There's certainly been quite a significant amount of defunding of science in New Zealand over the last 3 years, the loss of those long-term programs, and indeed in a number of our different funding grants have been massively reduced. That in some way contributed to the loss of some key staff that worked on the New Zealand Earth System model. And it does somewhat leave, you know, quite a high level of investment that was about 7 years in the making to create this model without much of a future, really. So we're still really waiting to see, I guess, if we can source some further funding to ensure that that model gets continued to develop and used, because it is able to demonstrate and resolve changes across the Southwest Pacific in a way that no other climate model can for New Zealand.
Well, given what we know about this past state of warming and our current failure to control greenhouse gases, Georgia, would you like to personally take a guess of what you think might happen by 2090 or 2100?
I mean, it's not looking great, Alex. As I said, you know, there are certain elements in the system that have very clear capacity to respond in a non-linear way, in a way where we see runaway change. Part of that is the West Antarctic ice sheet. If we start to break up our ice shelves, they act as a buttress to holding back a lot of that ice and also allow the incursion of warmer waters. And when I say warmer waters, I mean it doesn't need to be that warm. 0 degree water is still very warm to ice. You can still quickly melt ice under those conditions. We also have things like the methane cycle. You know, there are our ocean sediments as well as the permafrost that are starting to warm and potentially, you know, release huge amounts of methane, which are a very sensitive greenhouse gas. The important thing in all of this is that we, you know, everything we can do today to reduce our ongoing kind of carbon dioxide increase in the atmosphere will make a huge difference in that 80-year time frame.
What are you working on next?
Well, I have recently been to Greenland on one of the International Ocean Drilling Program voyages before they shut down, fortunately. And so I'm really starting to look into the details of the interactions between the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets and what we can learn from that. Because as we move forward in the future, I think one of our biggest questions we're facing is which ice sheet is going to respond the quickest and first, and how does that potentially force the other ice sheet to respond? Sea level rise doesn't rise evenly, just like global temperature doesn't rise evenly across the globe. And so it's really important that we know where that ice melt source might come from. That has a huge impact for different parts of the world. So if the Antarctic ice sheet melts, if we get, for example, 1 metre of sea level equivalent from the Antarctic ice sheet, then sea level rises higher than that in the Northern Hemisphere. So it might rise by 1.2 metres around the shores of Canada, sorry to say. And vice versa for New Zealand. If the Greenland ice sheet melts, then we experience higher than average effects of sea level rise. So it's really important that we know which of those ice sheets is more likely to respond and how they interact and impact each other.
We have been speaking with Dr. Georgia Grant. She is Senior Sedimentologist with the public research organization Earth Sciences of New Zealand. And you can find links to all the science we talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Georgia, thank you for spending time with our listeners.
Thanks, Alex. It's been a real pleasure.
That's it for this show. Check out all our past programs free at...
You're listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.